The cruel nature of the infinite inning is that it's a state of being where the road is shorter than the journey is long. Maybe that sounds like a cheap irony, but it seems like a fair analogy for the nature of life and time. We'll never perfect this project we're talking about, whatever our individual projects are. We'd like to keep trying to pursue the third out, but there are more batters to face than there is time. Paul Valéry said that works of art are never completed, only abandoned. So too, our lives and whatever progress we hope to make within them. I was deeply moved by what happened last week to the young Yankees outfielder Dustin Fowler. In case you missed it, the kid began the season as a Yankees prospect, although not a particularly highly ranked one. He was somewhere in the middle of the pack in a deep farm system. He's just 22 years old, and he moved up through a combination of attrition and his own good play, and finally got the call to the majors. He lasted not quite half an inning in his debut at Chicago against the White Sox. He didn't get to bat in the first inning, and when he went to right field for the bottom of the first, he chased a slicing fly ball that went down the foul line off the bat of Jose Abreu, and he didn't quite judge the low fence and the guardrail out there quite correctly, and he slammed into it with his knee. Joe Girardi, the Yankees manager, said there was an electrical box in there, too. It's hard to see that on the video. But in either case, he ruptured his patella tendon, and he's gone for the year. His major league debut, rookie season, and possibly his career all becoming highly attenuated at once. It was deeply upsetting to see someone achieve their dream and then have it snatched away all at the same time. With modern sports medicine, there's a good chance that Fowler can make it back in a reasonable period of time, not this year, but perhaps next year, and in roughly the same shape that he started in. But you don't know until it happens. You don't know if the opportunity will be there, if the ability will still be there, the mobility will still be there, the emotional ability, the sense of confidence, the poise that allows one to succeed in the high-pressure environment that is professional baseball. A great deal can change. You can change when you've suffered a severe injury. And what happens after isn't just about how that part of your body that was hurt responds to rehabilitation. I'm speaking from personal experience to an extent in that you've heard me refer to having had cancer on this program, and I had, when I was 32, ocular cancer, and the treatment for that to save my life caused me to be blind in one eye. And it's a small thing, a really small thing. And given that people die of cancer, I'm still here, and people lose more important things, lungs and chunks of their colon, and suffer all kinds of other disabling or debilitating effects. But I can tell you it's greatly affected my life, not just in the sheer number of things I bump into, including people when I'm walking down the street because I don't see them, but in my reluctance to go places and do things, and it's made me less social. It's made me uncomfortable in crowds. And don't get me wrong, I'm so grateful to be alive when so many other people who've received diagnoses like mine are not. But it turns out that you can have feelings of depression and inadequacy just based on something as small as a non-functional eye. So even if Fowler does come back and play at a high level, and I really do hope that he does, he might not be the same in some fundamental way. Fowler's mishap and quick exit might put you in mind of the story of someone like Moonlight Graham, the player who was performed by an elderly Burt Lancaster with so much twinkle he might have been using PEDs in the movie Field of Dreams. Not a fictional character, in 1905, Graham played a fraction of the game for the New York Giants and then never appeared in the majors again. But for some reason, I kept thinking of Joe Hauser, the young Philadelphia Athletics first baseman at the beginning of the 1920s. The parallel isn't perfect because he got a few years in before his career went wrong, but the comparison still seems apt. Very briefly, and I'm not going to do the story justice just now, Hauser was a young first baseman out of Milwaukee. He was called Unser Cho, our Joe, by the German population there, and he came up with the A's in 1922. He was quite the hitter, a left-hander. He had a lot of power. He finished second to Babe Ruth in home runs in 1924. He was a distant second, but there's no shame in being second to Babe Ruth in anything. In the brief time that he was a regular in the major leagues, he was routinely among the home run leaders. But it was all over by the time he was 25, and here's why. Just before the 1925 season started, which would have been his fourth campaign, the A's played an exhibition game, and a batter hit a ground ball between first and second. Hauser went to make the play, and his knee spontaneously and completely split in half down the middle. No one had touched him. There was no inciting incident. Obviously, there had to be some pre-existing flaw there, but it just broke. And that was the end of his season. He was 15 weeks in the hospital. It had to be sewed back together, essentially, with wire. He could never get reestablished in the major leagues, even though his bat did recover. Some of it was the knee struggled to regain flexibility. Some of it Hauser blamed on Ty Cobb, who was having his last year in the majors when Hauser was making another run at playing time, and Hauser claimed that Cobb sabotaged him with batting tips that were designed to make him fail. So he went back down to the minor leagues, and he just kept hitting. No one cared. He hit 63 home runs in 1930 for Baltimore of the International League. He hit 69 in 1933 for the Minneapolis Millers, and people talked about that the park had short fences and so on, but fine, discount them. It doesn't matter. He had the ability to play, and he could have helped a major league team, but no one called. The other knee went, and still he kept playing. He played until he was 43 years old. He lived until he was 98, and still no one called. Maybe the scouts just had a view they couldn't be budged off of. Maybe they thought that the kind of guy who would let Ty Cobb argue him out of his swing wasn't someone who was going to succeed. It's impossible to know at this late date, but it's frightening. Imagine you're a writer in possession of a great novel or screenplay. Imagine you're a holy man who claims he can perceive the nature of the divine. Imagine you're one of the greatest home run hitters of all time, with 399 in the minor leagues and another 80 in the major leagues, and no one in the majors will give you the time of day. The opportunity was there, and it was gone, and you do everything you can to earn it back, and it just will not be restored to you. That isn't Moses being shown the promised land but being denied entry to it. That is the deafness of an unfair world, and it scares the heck out of me. I'm Stephen Goldman, and this is the Infinite Inning Baseball Podcast. The tunnel under the POW camp was not discovered by the Germans until it was too late, and now you're closing in on the Swiss border, just beyond the mountains, the refuge that is episode 11. I hope you packed lightly. In just a few minutes, we'll be joined by today's guest, Eric Steven, the editor and author and overall auteur of the SB Nation site True Blue LA. Eric is fascinating not just because he's an indefatigable baseball writer, but he is someone who has taken the opportunity that has been offered by companies like SB Nation or Bleacher Report that says, come write for us and we won't necessarily pay you, but if you're good, you can parlay that into a kind of career. Well, Eric went from being a guy who, as he'll tell you, had a college degree that had nothing to do with baseball or baseball coverage and was working in a job for quite a long time that had nothing to do with baseball or baseball coverage. And yet today, he is in the Dodgers press box and clubhouse every single day and is a respected authority on that team. When more people than ever before want to get into the baseball writing field, I think his is a worthwhile story to know about. And it doesn't hurt that the team he covers is in first place in the National League West and looks like one of the better teams in all of baseball, a real World Series contender. And so we talk not only about him, but the Dodgers pennant chances, and various players on the team he's had a chance to observe close up, including Cody Bellinger, Justin Turner, and Yasiel Puig. First, though, a couple of minutes on the subject of fake news, a really fascinating topic in that it's now used to invalidate things you don't like. We get involved in the liar's paradox, the idea that you can say something like, this statement is false, and you're automatically tied up in a conundrum because if it is false, then it's true, and if it's true, it's false. So we have this way of messing with people's minds, and that's labeling something as fake news. But baseball doesn't have that. Say you're a Blue Jays fan, and last night Aaron Judge hit a home run against you. You can't really take that fact and say, fake news about it. Aaron Judge did not hit a home run against my team because it's either in the box score or it's not. It's either on the videotape or it's not. And unless you're going to claim that someone has altered either of those things in a massive conspiracy to boost Aaron Judge's home run totals. Actually, Yankee Stadium is a massive conspiracy to boost Aaron Judge's home run totals, but that's another story. Anyway, you can't invalidate that fact just by calling it something fake. The closest thing that we have to that is trade rumors. And I would think that people like our own John Heyman and Ken Rosenthal and so on are responsible, but that hasn't always been the case. And even when they are responsible, it sometimes might as well be fake. Because if you see a story that says, say, the Astros covet Jose Quintana, well, okay, they covet him. I mean, you may covet Jennifer Lawrence, but that's as far as it goes. Similarly, you may read a story that says, the Astros have called the White Sox about Jose Quintana. And you may have called Jennifer Lawrence, but she may not call you back. So again, like, people have conversations all the time. They wish for things all the time. They want things all the time. They may even ask for them all the time. But the fact that they have those feelings is not necessarily news. And yet, even that may be real. The closest thing I can think of to a story like that that actually is fake but did have an impact on the real world is that supposedly the reason that Yogi Berra got to be manager of the Yankees in 1964 is that some board sports writers decided to start a rumor, Yankees considering Yogi Berra for manager, and waited to see how fast it would bounce back to them along the Twilight Bark, the telephone line of sports journalism. And somehow in the process of that happening, the Yankees sort of went, oh, we're considering him? Well, I suppose we should get him signed then. So he got to be manager for a while, and even if he wasn't quite prepared for it and the circumstances weren't ideal in a lot of ways, they did win the pennant. But that was something that began as fake news and became real news. I don't think it happens that way very often. And here's another thing that doesn't happen. Baseball pioneered the idea of confronting your accuser when it comes to the guy who's shouting fake news. And it's really only happened once that I can think of. But it's so enticing. It's so attractive as something that should happen, that you should have the right to testify on the behalf of the story that you're filing, one way or another, right or wrong. This happened in Brooklyn in 1943. It is a long and elaborate story, and I'm going to try to tell it quickly and kind of boil it down to the essentials. I'm going to do this from memory, or mostly from memory, so forgive me if I fudge anything. It involves Leo Durocher, who is managing the Brooklyn Dodgers at that point, and Leo was not a guy who ever exactly had a reputation for, let's say, sterling conduct or honesty. I mean, going back to when he first came to the major leagues as a shortstop with the Yankees, he was accused of being a clubhouse thief, and Babe Ruth, and he got into a fist fight because supposedly he stole Babe Ruth's watch out of his locker, and he just kind of rolled on that way, doing what he felt like doing and not necessarily telling the truth. If he got caught, he'd just deny it. Harold Parrott of the Brooklyn Daily Eagle wrote, on the charge of denying statements he'd unquestionably made, Durocher has been convicted before. Lippy's behavior is based almost entirely on convenience. If it becomes inconvenient to have said something, Leo just decides he never did say it. Veteran newspapermen have known this for years, but apparently Lippy's players have just discovered it. Remind me to comment another time on the defunct Brooklyn Daily Eagle's habit in the 40s and 50s of its sports section referring to everyone by nicknames, so that every story about a game is that Lippy ordered Dixie to throw the ball to Goo Goo, and you really have to have a code. It's not a difficult code, but it's just so cute as to be really annoying. Goo Goo, by the way, was Augie Gallen, a really underrated player, kind of the Bernie Williams of the 30s and 40s, but I as usual, digress. Okay, so 1943. The Dodgers are a really good team, although they're being sapped by World War II. They won 100 games in the pennant in 1941. They won 100 in 1942, but they finished second to the Cardinals, who won even more. Some of the good players are starting to go into the military, and they're patching with a lot of veterans. Archie Vaughn, the great Pirates shortstop, is playing for them in place of Pee Wee Reese, and Paul Wehner, who's 40, is in their outfield, and they have some other veteran guys like the aforementioned Dixie Walker, the first baseman Dolph Camilli, and pitchers like the rage-filled Johnny Allen, and most essential in this story, Bobo Newsom. Bobo on his own is a long story, and there's so many things that we could talk about with him. The fact that he changed teams 17 times, the fact that he played for the Washington Senators 5 times, and the Browns 3 times, and the Dodgers twice, and so on. That he called everybody Bobo, including himself. So it was both a first and a third person name. He was a 200 game winner and a 200 game loser. Sometimes he was Max Scherzer and sometimes he was Bud Norris. He lost 20 games three times, but he also won 20 games three times. Although one of those times he had an ERA of 5.08. He was an extraordinary player. The thing that I love about him perhaps most is that he was virtually indestructible. I mean, not only did he pitch into his 40s, but he suffered injuries on the field that were so horrific that would hospitalize any player today, and yet he would stay in the game. This is later in that year, 1943, a description of a game that he pitched against the St. Louis Browns, because by the end of this story, although he starts with the Dodgers, I will tell you ahead of time that he does not finish the story with the Dodgers. The score was 2-2 in the last of the fifth when pitcher Oscar Lefty Judd of the Red Sox blasted a drive which caromed off Newsom's left forehead over Don Gutteridge's head and into deep right center field. Bobo slightly blocked the smash with his glove hand, but only slightly, and it was fortunate for him then that the ball hit him a glancing blow. He did not collapse or even fall to the ground. He walked to the Browns' dugout, sat on top of the step for cold water applications, and was greeted with wild cheers when he gamely returned. Allow me to translate. The Browns pitcher hit a 400-foot line drive off of the opposing pitcher's head, and the pitcher stayed in the game. But that was not unusual for Bobo. There was an opening day when he was with the Senators when Franklin Roosevelt was in attendance, and after Roosevelt signed a ball for him, he signed a ball for Roosevelt, even though Roosevelt did not ask for him to do that. He then went to the mound. The Indians were the opposing team. He got ahead of Earl Averill, shouted, "Now Bobo will strike you out with a curveball." Averill, knowing this, was on top of the curveball and lined it up the middle off of Bobo's knee. That was the first inning. He stayed in and completed the game. It was only after that he said to the trainer, "Bobo thinks his leg is broke." And indeed, Bobo's leg was broken. He had pitched the entire game that way. On another occasion, he was pitching against the Yankees, and Ben Chapman laid down a bunt, and the Senators' third baseman, Ossie Bluegee, came in and made a great play and was going to fire the ball to first, but either he or Bobo did not realize that Bobo's head was in the way and at point-blank range. Bobo was sculled by his own third baseman, and all the descriptions of the game say that he sort of did a weird little dance. Wounded moose is the term that's often used. He sort of stumbled around the infield confusedly for a moment, but once again he stayed in, and he threw a complete game shutout. His jaw had been broken in two places. On yet another occasion, I believe this was when he was pitching very successfully for the Detroit Tigers, the throw from the first baseman on a 3-1 putout tailed into the runner, leading the runner to run into Bobo's pitching hand. His thumb was broken in two places, and again, he stayed in, or in this case, at least he tried. It's hard to grip your pitches when your thumb is swelling and you can't really move it. Sometimes he's portrayed as stupid, but I don't think he was stupid. I think he was fairly smart. I think he was amused. I think he did a lot to entertain himself. I think he did a lot to entertain others. And since he was often stuck on tail-end clubs, he kind of did what he could to attract a crowd. He figured that would make him more valuable. He even said as much. By 1943, he's in his mid-30s. He's pitching for the Dodgers. He's actually leading the team in wins at this point in the season. But in mid-July, there's an incident. The Dodgers have a kid shortstop who they're trying to convert to catcher named Bobby Bregan. Bregan would be in the game for forever as a coach and manager and that kind of thing. But at this point, he's just struggling to hang on. And he's the battery with Newsom in this game. In the early innings of the game, there's a 3-2 pitch with a runner on third. And there's a cross-up. The catcher, Bregan, is expecting a fastball, and Newsom threw something else. What it was is was the subject of the controversy. The ball took a weird break, and it bounced and goes all the way to the backstop, and the runner scores. Now, this turns out to be immaterial to the outcome of the game, which the Dodgers eventually come back and win. But in the moment, Newsom showed a lot of frustration. He put his hands on his hips. At the end of the inning, he threw his glove in the air. And this was obviously embarrassing to the kid catcher. Leo Durocher, who liked the kid very much, was really angry. And there had been conflicts between him and Newsom already, in part because Leo is a super type A person. Newsom is kind of a super type Z person. He's incredibly relaxed and mellow. And again, not somebody who takes coaching real well, possibly because he knows he cannot be killed. There's a confrontation after the game in the clubhouse about how Newsom had shown up Bregan and how Newsom had thrown a spitter and crossed the kid up, and he did it just to make him look bad. and words go back and forth. And at the end of it, Durocher says to Newsom, "You're suspended. You're suspended indefinitely for the season if I can get Branch Rickey to make it stick." All right, fine. This is like a thing that happens. Tempers get overheated. Durocher would do this sometimes. Newsom provoked people into it plenty of times. Not a big deal. But Durocher made a mistake. The timing of the argument is such that the rest of the players don't witness it. They don't know about the suspension. And Leo, still in the clubhouse, feeling his manhood a little bit in this moment of leadership, starts bragging on the argument and what he had told Newsom in earshot of a reporter. And the reporter asks, "Is this for publication?" And Leo is okay with it. And eventually it finds its way into the paper. The first the players hear about it is when they read it over breakfast the next morning. And they're outraged. It seems like an overreaction, and Leo's been riding them hard, so they don't have a lot of tolerance for this kind of dictatorial behavior. Particularly Archie Vaughn is incredibly upset by this. Players come in for the game, and there's a confrontation in the clubhouse. They ask Leo, "Did you really say all that stuff? Did you really suspend Newsom for the season?" And he, desperate, cornered, denies it. They don't buy it at all. They do not buy it. Archie Vaughn turns in his uniform and says he's done with the team, that Durocher's a liar. He's not going to play for a guy who lies, because if Durocher lied about Newsom, he could lie about him. Dixie Walker also refuses to play. And suddenly, the Dodgers don't have a team. The umpires send a bat boy in to say, "You guys didn't show up on the field for batting practice. We're ready to start the game. Where are you?" And Durocher actually has to say, "Well, we'll see if we have nine guys. If we have nine guys, we'll play. If we don't, we're going to forfeit." And there's an extraordinary scene as he goes down the roster saying, "Billy Herman, do you want to play? Yes or no? Paul Wehner, do you want to play? Yes or no?" Now, the players have already gotten word from Branch Rickey that if they refuse to play, they're not only going to be suspended, they're going to be blacklisted. So everybody but Archie Vaughn goes along with it. Archie Vaughn stays in his civilian clothes. He has literally given his uniform to Leo Durocher and told him to shove it up his ass. Meanwhile, Durocher has called the sports writer who was standing right there, his name was Tim Cohane, and denied the story and called it a lie. He's called it a lie to the players. He's called it a lie to the reporter. The reporter, who was not in the ballpark that day, it was his day off, calls Branch Rickey and says, "I demand the right to confront my accuser." And the next day, even though Leo and Rickey, they don't want this, there is another clubhouse meeting. In front of all the players and the assembled writers, Cohane cross-examines Leo Durocher, even concluding with, "The prosecution rests." Durocher is rapidly forced to admit that, yes, it all actually did happen the way it was reported. The crime is a small crime. It's that he looks petty. And then, as usual, the cover-up was the worst thing, that he lied, and it was one lie too many for his players. At this point, the Dodgers hit the All-Star break, and for a few days, Durocher's job hung in the balance. His credibility is just shot. Ultimately, Rickey decided to keep him on. However, that didn't leave him with much ability to keep the players on, and he had to clean house. Veterans start leaving town. Somehow, Newsom goes through waivers instantly and winds up back with the Browns, and perhaps not coincidentally, this was one day before he was due to receive a rostering bonus. The Dodgers, who were a close second to the Cardinals at that moment, have a losing record over the rest of the season, and they don't really get back to where they were going until after the war. The biggest casualty is probably Vaughn, who was so disgusted with Durocher that, although he did finish the season, he immediately retired and stayed retired for 3 years. He came back in 47 after Leo was gone. This directly impacted his Hall of Fame candidacy. He made it in 1985, but it was long after he was dead. Now, it wasn't something he was fated to live to see in any case, because he died young at 40 in a boating accident. He drowned in Crater Lake. Nonetheless, the missing time retarded his career totals, and it took voters a while to look around the counting stats to see the sheer quality of the player. Regardless, think about the drama of that scene, but think also about the attempt to bring integrity to the proceedings. Leo Durocher had popped off at a pitcher, done something too extreme, and then, to cover it up, said, "Fake news." And the reporter who wrote the story went before him, went before his peers, went before the players, defended himself, and it was revealed not to be fake news. Leo was shown to be a liar. The revolt was suppressed because players didn't have a lot of rights in those days, and there really wasn't anywhere for them to go with it anyway once Ricky decided to sustain DeRocher in his job. But shouldn't it be that way? I don't know how we would do it at scale, but there has to be a way, because you cannot convince people in the culture at large, the society at large, that a story is true when there are two sides. There are always people who will have so open a mind that they will consider both sides, even when it is literally impossible for both sides to have equal legitimacy. Or they will have such a fealty to a voice of authority that says fake news that they will say, okay, must be fake news, because that guy wouldn't lie. He's the voice of authority. This is a problem in people, a cognitive problem that you might call, and other people did call in other contexts, the leadership principle. The only way to show them the reality of a situation, the accuracy of a situation, is to change the way they perceive that story. And there's only one way to do that. Get people's attention, lay it out step by step the way Cohane did, and force them to process it. Further, the denialists, the people who cry fake news, the impetus should be as much on them to prove the veracity of what they're saying as on the people presenting the story in the first place, if not more so. They're the ones who should be presenting evidence that what they're saying isn't fake news. DeRocher couldn't do that. The reporter said, were you in this time and place? DeRocher had to say yes. Were you talking to this person? DeRocher had to say yes. And did you actually do this thing? And DeRocher had to say yes. And that was the end of it. And you know what? For that and for many other reasons, Leo, too, didn't get into the Hall of Fame until after his death, and it was purely punitive. And I'm not saying that it was the right thing to do or that it was directly related to that 1943 incident, but it was part of it. He damaged his credibility forever. And you know what? That's a worthwhile thing. That is a great achievement, not for DeRocher, but for everyone else, for all of us. And if we had that in our lives, this would be a better world to live in. I'll be back with Eric Steven in just a moment. I'm so pleased to be joined right now by someone who is just an amazing, multifaceted Swiss Army knife of a person. And I think what people don't realize about major sports news sites and probably all news sites is that one way that you're able to be so quick with publication of a breaking story is that you write it before it happens.
When I was SB Nation's managing editor for baseball,
I always felt like I was a little behind the curve on that, because you're watching a game, you're watching the seventh game of the World Series, you're trying to track the action, you're trying to run updates and be aware of when you should run an update. And it's hard sometimes to think about whether you have a story set up for as soon as the last ball drops, and or when the next game is, if it's not the seventh game. Obviously, if it's the seventh game, there's not the next game till the next year. And Eric Steven, who has been at SB Nation for forever, and in addition to being the editor of True Blue LA, does a lot of stuff on the main site, was always about 10 steps ahead of me on that. I would say, you know, I think we need to set up a post for the next game. And he would say, yeah, I already did it a week ago. So I was always so impressed with that. And I always wondered why our roles weren't reversed, because maybe he should have been doing the directing and I should have been doing the posting. But it was a real pleasure to work with him. And I'm so happy to welcome him to the program. How are you, Eric?
Oh, very good, Stephen. Thanks for having me.
You're in the Dodgers clubhouse most days. You've been following the team. You're not just an armchair guy, but you're out there doing the beat work and reporting on the team firsthand. And there's so much about that I want to ask you. But the first question, one that I think probably a lot of people would like to know, is what is it like watching Cody Bellinger blossom close up?
It's kind of crazy because, you know, I tend to people get a little too prospect happy sometimes. And I think my general reflex over the last, like, you know, I've been at True Blue LA for, I think this is my ninth year. And just over time, you sort of get beaten down by hope, I guess is the way to put it. And so my general reflex has always been to sort of couch that hope. Like, look, it's not everyone's going to be, you know, Clayton Kershaw. Not everyone, you know, And last year, I think 2015, I'll even give Jock Peterson credit. He had a bad second half, but as in terms of like delivering a prospect to the majors, like he performed about as well as you could have imagined. But then Corey Seager had like every expectation in the world on him, and he like exceeded him somehow last year. So he kind of came to the team as a ready-made, factory-made superstar. Cody Bellinger's kind of in that same light. In my mind, like he wasn't the top-rated prospect, but he was close enough coming into this year. And then he was when he got called up in April, he was only supposed to be up for like a week to 10 days. They had a couple outfield injuries. Adrian Gonzalez was still sort of nominally healthy, and so the thought was he was just going to be up for a brief time. And then he just kept hitting, and it became obvious like he's never going anywhere. But then he kept adding and adding and adding. And I mean, to hit as many home runs as he has, it's just been ridiculous. And just to have this like 2 years in a row, I don't know how to act really like at this point because it's so bizarre. But then the funny thing is like he's like he has like a pretty good head on his shoulders. Obviously, his dad was a major leaguer, Clay Bellinger, and he seems like he's just kind of amused by it all. Like he doesn't seem like overwhelmed by anything, and he doesn't seem like he's like too cool for school or something like that. I don't know, but it's been remarkable. Like because you're talking about like pre-writing stuff, a lot of stuff like on a even smaller level than that. Like during the game, I'll be looking frantically searching the play index on Baseball Reference, you know, looking for what the Dodger record is for a player doing X in their first 30 games. And then Bellinger's playing like in his 31st game. So I'll look up that. And he's been constantly like beating like every record almost. After a while, it got to a point where, oh, he's beating like the major league records for some of these. Like, and I think he's still the fastest to wherever he's at now. I think he's at 24 home runs or whatever. But it's been remarkable, really. And like, I don't know if he's a 50 home run hitter in his rookie season, but he's on pace for it, which is weird. Home runs are definitely up this year, so you have to maybe discount that a little bit. But just the fact that he missed the first 3 weeks of the season, he's leading the National League in home runs. That doesn't really happen. The Dodgers don't lead the league in home runs. Like that's not their thing. So it's weird that they're actually getting guys who do this. So it's very odd.
What was strange about it was that it seemed to me, and I don't know if it was the Dodgers or the media that was unprepared for it, but as you said, it was supposed to be a short stay, right? A little temporary patch given all the injuries that they had. And he hit so many home runs so fast. I'm not sure of the exact date or how many games into his stay that it happened, but in very short order, he was leading the team in home runs. Yeah. And yet the media was still saying, well, he's going to be going down any day now when, you know, Trace Thompson comes back or something. And I kept thinking, no, he's not. But they kept saying it for much longer than it seemed like it could possibly apply. Was that the media or was that the Dodgers trying to stick to their plan?
I think it was the question was asked of Dave Roberts quite a bit. So I think it was like a daily question. So I think that's why it kept getting sort of repeated. So I think it's more in the Dodgers than the media in that case. But I think I'm trying to remember his initial call up was Jock Peterson went on the deal. I think he had a groin injury. So that sort of opened the gates a little bit. Andrew Tolles was still around at that time. And the funny part is Andrew Tolles was tied for the team lead in home runs when he went down with five, I believe at the time. He injured his ACL, which was sort of the move that like kind of cleared everything away. You hate to say that. Obviously he was an important part of last season and this year. He's out for the year with ACL. He was playing a lot in left field. So that really opened up left field for Bellinger. But at the same time, when Jock Peterson was coming back was when Bellinger was, that was the decision point basically on Bellinger. And like you said, he was hitting. I think the tipping point was they had this game against Philadelphia where the Dodgers were down three in the ninth when they hit three consecutive home runs. And I think Bellinger was the middle one of that. And he had two home runs in that game. You're just thinking like, yeah, this guy's never going down. And I think that's sort of when the tipping point happened. But then also the fact that Adrian Gonzalez has not really been healthy all year. He had elbow problems in spring training. He's been dealing with a herniated disc in his back as well, which has sort of been the bigger problem. He had one home run, or he had zero home runs at the time when he first went on the DL. He came back, he hit one, and then he got hurt again. But before he had gone on the DL, this is like the Iron Man of baseball. the modern, like post Ripken, I guess, 11 straight years of like 156 plus games. He had never been on the disabled list. So that was like a big thing. Dave Roberts like adores Gonzalez. They used to be teammates. So it was a really difficult thing to get that first DL stint out of the way. And so basically what happened was when Peterson came back off the DL, the corresponding move instead of Bellinger was finally convincing Gonzalez to go on the DL because he was not producing. When he's healthy, he's a good hitter, but he was not healthy and not doing anything. So they kind of convinced him to go on the DL. Basically since then, it's just, and then Bellinger took it to like another level to where he's now it's like instead of maybe going back down, you know, in a few weeks, it's never playing in the minors again, ever. So
let me ask the obvious sequel question to that. And I think the answer is equally obvious, but baseball teams have a way of making this complicated. Adrian Gonzalez has obviously had a great career. I don't know that he's a Hall of Famer, but he's certainly a Hall of Very Good kind of guy. Sure. His 2016 was not great. And I don't know if that was just an off year or an aging thing, because he is getting up there in years. He's signed for another season for something like $23.5 million, I think is the number, or maybe $22.5 million. It's still a lot of money to just eat if it came to that, especially if the organization does love you, especially if the manager is a close personal friend. It doesn't seem like he's coming back anytime soon, but right now we have kind of a classic Wally Pipp situation. Uh-huh. And I know that the Dodgers still are kind of short of outfielders, but Bellinger's also a really good glove at first base.
Yeah.
It seems weird to push him off his natural position for a guy who really hasn't given you anything, again, not just this year, but was kind of dragging last year. So what happens when he does come back, or if he does come back?
I think Gonzalez will still get quite a bit of rope. Because I think you're right. He was not productive in 2016. Part of that was also health. He was dealing with the sort of herniated disc like off and on at times. But I mean, he wasn't, you know, in theory hurt enough to go on the DL. So like, I'm not trying to make excuses. But there was a point last year where I think it was in like late June where he was lost. Like he even said like his swing was lost. He basically took 2 days off. He didn't start two straight games, which was a big deal because he always starts. After that, like he kind of started hitting again. And like, I think about the second half of the season, he was hitting more home runs, more doubles. Cause he hits a lot of doubles too, in addition to the home runs. And he really wasn't doing either of those. For me, I look at 2016 in like two parts. There was like the reasonably rested, healthy Gonzalez. And then, you know, before that. So I don't know. I'm still of the mind that if he's anywhere close to healthy, he's going to play first base until his contract's up. But, you know, he's been saying like, if he's still dealing with this, like next year, he's just going to retire at the end of his contract. I think he's tired of dealing with it, but I think they're probably more inclined to make him maybe more of a platoon player. He's had trouble against lefties like 3 out of the last 4 years. Generally over his career, he's hit them well, but just really hasn't the last, you know, 3 or 4 years. So they'll probably treat him more like a platoon player when he's back. So Bellinger will get some run there because he's been playing every day, you know, no platoon there. But I do think it's going to be more Bellinger, the outfielder, than Gonzalez, first base. But also I think there'll probably be more, you know, if they think Gonzalez is still hurting into next year, they're probably more likely to place him on the DL for stints at a time just because they've sort of popped that cherry and they're willing to sort of go that route.
What's your sense of him as a person? Because I never was clear. He was part of that kind of bad Boston clubhouse situation that lost Terry Francona's job, and there was the whole beer and fried chicken thing.
Yeah.
But I don't know if he was key to that so much as just his contract was not a great contract, and Boston needed to start over. I don't think he came out of that perfectly clean either. Was that aberrant? Is he a guy who is a good clubhouse presence for the Dodgers?
Yeah, he's definitely been a overwhelming like plus, I think, for them. I know part of the thing too in Boston, if I remember right, was I think he was the guy who went to ownership first to like basically complain about Valentine, which in hindsight seemed like, you know, completely valid complaints. but I don't think you want to have the stain of being like the tattletale on, you know, probably. And that probably helped like grease the skids for him getting out of Boston. Yeah. It's been a weird like clubhouse. He's a quiet guy, or at least outwardly, probably. I'm sure in the clubhouse when the media isn't around, he's definitely more vocal. He's more of a stoic guy. He knows, I think he has a very good sense of like where he stands in the clubhouse, and like, he always struck me as a guy, even who probably wouldn't admit it, but like he struck me as a guy who like always knows what his stats are. Not that he plays for his stats, but just that he's a very aware. You know, he's very good situational hitter. He's prepares like nobody else. He's been sort of like a mentor. Like, you know, of all the troubles like Yasiel Puig has, it's usually like Adrian Gonzalez or someone who'll pull him aside. It's, you always kind of hear that a little bit where it's usually Adrian Gonzalez is the guy to like get to him, or there's been others as well. But yeah, Gonzalez has been sort of like that quiet behind the scenes guy. He's not, I don't think he's like the necessarily the go-to in the clubhouse, but yeah, definitely been a positive overall.
So let me talk about you a little bit for a second. I'm always surprised to remember that you grew up in Palm Springs, because I didn't think people actually grew up in Palm Springs. I thought that was just a place that kind of activates when a millionaire comes in to play golf, and otherwise, you know, it's kind of like Disneyland. It closes at the end of the day and they clean it up and it reopens the next day. So what was that like?
It was weird, because you're right. It's almost a town, you know, literally built on tourism. It was known for, yeah, celebrities, golf, and like spring break, basically, for years and years. So I, yeah, born in the nearby San Bernardino, and I've been in Southern California like my whole life. But K through 12, I was in Palm Springs, so it was very, I was used to the heat. I don't know, I kind of liked it. Like, I don't, it was weird because I got used to the heat. Is oppressive. It's really bad. Like, you know, 120 in the summers. Wow. It gets to, we used to have like, not races, but like just sort of a game to see how early in the day it would get to 100. And, you know, there'd be days where it's like, you know, 9:15 a.m. and it's 100.
Wow.
It's just ridiculous. So growing up there, like, I was just kind of used to it. And so it's just what you dealt with. And I went to college at UCSD in San Diego. And I just remember, you know, that's like the greatest climate in the world. And it's most comfortable you could possibly be naturally. And then I remember going home in the summer, and immediately I was just like, nope, I hate this. I hate this weather now. So I can no longer deal with 120 degrees in the summer.
How is that sustainable? I mean, not to turn you into an ecological or environmental expert, but this is a town in a desert, and it's also a town of 150 golf courses or something like that.
Yeah.
How do you sustain that, especially in a state that, less so this year, but running up to this year, has had these massive drought problems?
No, it's a big problem. That's a huge thing. I think, I honestly don't know. I think they probably had to close a few golf courses, or just have kept them in really bad shape. I think how you deal with just the sustainability, like, it's usually up there in like terms of cities with pools per capita. It's always fun if you want to just look at a map of like old Palm Springs, or just like near downtown where the residential neighborhoods are. If you just look at an overlay like on Google, and you just see pools in like almost every backyard. So it's kind of funny. Like, so I think that was the thing. There's always a pool nearby. And like you said, there's golf. But I don't really know. I honestly don't know. They were, and spring training was so huge there, and then it kind of died, I think, around the time, like, and Sonny Bono was mayor when I was there. So
right.
It was just bizarre. It was a bizarre time, really.
So you went off to UCSD, like you said, San Diego, which spoils my joke, because I was kind of hoping there was a UC South Dakota. I think that would be kind of really amusing. But you come out of there with an economics degree.
Yep.
And you end up being a full-time sports writer and editor. So how do you go from being a proto Paul Krugman to being the Red Smith of the Dodgers?
It gets even weirder, because not only I had an economics degree, but I didn't even use that for like my first like foray into the job world. I sort of stumbled into this internship at a commercial real estate office. My my last year at college, that sort of blossomed into like a full-time job starting out. So it was fine. And then I ended up basically doing that for like almost 10 years. I wasn't doing like brokerage, but I was more like the back office guy. I would like, it was a small company, so they, you know, there's no real like departments. So like I eventually was running the company website. I was doing, helping out with like the marketing of the properties, designing some of the flyers. Eventually I did like the payroll for them. Like I was like jack of all trades. I liked it, but it wasn't like my passion. Like I was commenting for a while on John Wiseman's Dodger Thoughts site and got to know quite a few like friends through that. And, you know, I mean, basically like that's what I love following baseball since I was a kid. So, and it was like, you know, always thinking about it. So that was a great outlet for me, just being in like the comments section there. And it was a great sort of community. Over time, one of our friends, Phil Gurney, was co-writing at True Blue LA on SB Nation. Wasn't as big as it was then. This was like 2008. I think they had sites for every team, but they were, you know, much smaller. There were two writers on the site. Andrew Grant was the other one, and real life takes over sometimes. So he stopped kind of writing on the site. So Phil needed someone to sort of carry the load a little bit, and so he asked me if I wanted to write for the site, and I said yeah. And I started in like December of 2008. I don't know, I something clicked, and I just started writing a lot, and I writing a lot more. And 2009 was weird because Josh Rowich at the time was the PR guy for the Dodgers, and they were you know, in the McCourt years, and I sort of gained because of the McCourt years. They were unhappy with the coverage they were receiving, which was sort of the real backstory behind this. But the Dodgers decided to open up the press box. So they opened up like one seat. They called it the blog spot. So it was a case by case, game by game basis, first come, first serve. If you want to cover a game, you know, do that. So my problem was I had moved from San Diego to the high desert in Southern California, basically Victorville on the way to Vegas, if you're from out here. So, I had never really lived within, like, I had always been like a 90-minute drive away from LA. So covering like every game was not, you know, an option. And obviously I didn't have the time, or, you know, and I was working a real job, so I couldn't really do that. So 2009 was I was writing like every day for the site, but then I would take advantage, and I think I covered 10 games that year in person, which was amazing. And, you know, I obviously never experienced that, but I think they were like almost all Sunday games. Just, you know, it was the easiest day for me to get out there. But of all the people who had like taken advantage of this blog spot, I think I was just the one who, once my foot was in the door, I just like kind of took advantage of it. And the next year I did a few more games. It was like in the 20s, and then in the 40s. And then, so this is like after like 2011, Josh Sushan, who was the co-host of Dodger Talk, he now does Albuquerque Isotopes play-by-play. He used to do like, it was, I forgot what it was called, but it was through, I think, Sports Exchange. They provided like weekly updates to USA Today, daily updates to USA Today, weekly updates to Yahoo, little notes types things. And, you know, you just sort of have to file something, you know, 6 days a week, basically. And that was like a freelance gig. And he said, hey, why don't you should call this guy and see if that's something you would be interested to do. You could earn a little extra money. And like at the time I was with SB Nation, I was doing not only True Blue LA, but they expanded to these regional sites. And I was running the LA site, which was doing all sports. So that, you know, this was in addition to my like real estate job. So this was like kind of, you know, just money on the side, basically. But then I was kind of doing the math, and so if I do this freelance gig doing the notes for Sports Exchange, but also it was going to be game recaps, and then also with True Blue LA and Sport and SB Nation LA, I was like, I think I can kind of swing that if I didn't have like a ton of expenses. So I basically called my cousin, and I said, hey, do you think I should like stay on your couch for like a couple months till I get on my feet? He said, sure. So I basically like in February 2012, I moved out of my little apartment in the high desert, put like all my stuff in storage, And then I filled my car up and drove straight to spring training. And I covered like every day of spring training that year because I had nowhere else to go. And so, I was basically doing that for, for ever since, basically. Then in August of that year, I started doing more editing work for the .com side of SB Nation. And that sort of filled in some of the other, like the monetary gaps that were sort of missing. So this is my sixth year of doing that. And I've gone to spring training like every year, and it's been crazy, but like, cause I didn't think that was ever going to, possible. But it was funny because I was so blind. I remember I found a place on Craigslist to stay in spring training, and it was like super cheap. It was like, I think I paid $700 for like 6 weeks to just stay. It was in a loft in like a lady's apartment, and she was actually completely cool, and it was actually a really good setup. But like that could have been terrible, I was flying blind there, and I just was going into a very unknown situation, but it worked out. It's been like a crazy fun ride ever since.
Well, it's good that you had a sense of professionalism about it. And I can remember early in my career when I first was going into the clubhouse for various publications at Yankee Stadium, the old Yankee Stadium, that a memo was distributed by one of the people I was writing for with a list of do's and don'ts for behavior in the clubhouse. And some of them were kind of obvious, but maybe people needed to be reminded, like, don't ask for autographs. That's just automatic termination. You can't do that as a professional, although I've seen people do it. But the other things like wear appropriate attire, like wear pants. Don't eat the player's post-game spread. Don't just reach into a player's locker and start fooling around with his personal stuff. Like things that you wouldn't do, never mind being in a clubhouse on your job. But if you were visiting someone's house, just as on a social basis, you wouldn't, like, at least most of us, I don't think, would start going through their drawers or anything.
Right.
Or just helping themselves to the refrigerator. But obviously you knew how to carry yourself right away.
Yeah, and it's like, yeah, don't murder a guy, or something like that. You always wonder, I've seen those as well, and you just wonder, how many people had to have violated this before they decided to have to put it in writing, like, it's pretty funny. I think a couple years ago, too, I forgot if it was MLB or the BBWAA put out a thing about you had to wear, like, closed shoes in the clubhouse because they were going through that MRSA thing in the clubhouse.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
But I just laugh because, like, I would never think of wearing, like, flip-flops, basically. But I've seen it. Like, it happens. Like, so it's weird. Yeah, I that was a thing. I was very good about sort of laying low. If I didn't have something to say, I wouldn't, like, force myself into the situation. But I was also very fortunate because a lot of the guys on the beat were super helpful because I think part of it was because they saw me, like, actually working hard and doing it. Doing, pretty good work, I guess. Dylan Hernandez at the time, Ken Gernick, who's still there, Tony Jackson, who's no longer in the business, but he was super great to me. They were all, like, amazingly helpful, and, like, they would answer questions if I had them. But, it was very intimidating. For me, the hardest thing, Joe Torre was the manager at the time, and, he has obviously a certain stature in baseball, and I just remember being so intimidated when I first was in those manager scrums, the pregame sort of lounging around in the dugout and then talking to the manager about, the day's news or whatever before the game. After like a couple games, I just realized, I'm like, this actually is not bad at all. Like, you just have to wait for your spot and then just go in with a question, and they always answered it. Like, he was very good about that. And like, Torre was very good about that too. Like, he didn't go like, well, who the hell are you? Or that. So he was very good about it. So yeah, I just think, like you said, part of it was hard work that was recognized, and that sort of helped me out. But I just remember too, when I jumped in full time, I had, at the time, I was like, I would get credentials like game by game. I applied for in 2012 in spring for the daily credential from the Dodger, like the annual one, just so I didn't have to get daily credentials. And it was like not a given that I was going to get this, because I was still, my main site was writing for a blog, essentially. I just remember it was near the end of spring training, and one of the Dodgers PR guys came over to me. I forgot exactly what he said, but basically, like, look, you got your credential. And I almost, like, literally cried right there. It was, It was awesome. It was a great moment.
Since you worked with Joe Torre, and I did too, or covered, I guess is the better word, when he was obviously with the Yankees for forever. Unlike you, I was largely not in the clubhouse every day. It was a thing where, since I've always been more of a columnist than a straight reporter, that I would parachute in and parachute out. I usually came in with some specific agenda, some player, whether in the home clubhouse or a visitor that I wanted to talk to, and everything else that I got was just kind of gravy. So as you said, when you were starting out, I tried to stay out of the way of the beat guys who really were there all season long, because I knew they had a job to do. And if I was in the way, just striking up casual conversations with players without really a professional goal, then I was probably deflecting somebody else from doing their job. So I just tried to be as unobtrusive as possible. But I did attend many of Joe Torre's pregame scrums. And like you said, he liked to have them outside. He would come in. You'd see him if you got there early enough. You know, he would come in, he would work out. And I always loved the fact that he worked out because, you know, as a player, he was a chunky guy. Okay. So here, even in his old age, he's working out, and you see him go through the clubhouse in his towel and his exercise clothing. He gets changed, and then everybody goes out to the dugout. And I quickly learned that you had to, you know, put your recording device pretty much behind his head somewhere so you could get the sound. But he did this passive aggressive thing, at least I think it was, in that he's surrounded, particularly, I assume Los Angeles media is the same, but he's surrounded by a good 50, 60 guys, maybe more, television writers. And somebody would say, you know, hey, Joe, is Tino Martinez has a groin pull. Is he going to play today? And Joe's answer, which would be lengthy and thorough, he would speak it at about minus 50 decibels. He would be very, very quiet. And all I could hear, if I was, and sometimes I got lucky and I'd be sitting somehow right next to him. But other times, if you're on the outside of the scrum, all I would hear him say is, and there'd be airplanes passing overhead, and the ballpark organist would be warming up. And I honestly went through many of those things without a clue as to a single thing that he said. And it was only when I played it back later that I understood that he'd said anything at all.
Yeah, so it's weird because I think he was probably a little better, like, but I've been there where if the scrum's big enough, like, you're on the outside, unless your recorder's up close, you're kind of not hearing much, you know? And sometimes I find myself hesitant to ask a question because it might have already been answered. I just didn't hear it, you know, in the moment. Right. But not, this is not just with Torre. But you know what's weird about that too is that, given how big the market is, I would say the LA media in general, or just in terms of how it translates to like baseball coverage, is like minuscule compared to like New York or even Boston. I know like Boston, you have like so many like competing beat writers in the local market. Here, I mean, that was honestly part of the reason they opened up the blog spot. The local Riverside Press Enterprise, which had covered for years, they stopped sending their beat writers traveling. Right now, basically, it's the LA Times, MLB.com, and then the LA Area News Group, which bought out like it was LA Daily News, Orange County Register. Those are all under the same umbrella now. Those are the three traveling like beat writers that go to trips. So it's a small like group. Obviously, with home games, there's more because TV shows up, and then people who are not always there tend to show up for home games. But in general, I would say it's much smaller than that on a game by game basis. But yeah, there's been, you know, those huge scrums are, it's still that same thing where you kind of have to use your recorder to your advantage at that point.
That was a real shock to me, that imbalance in media. And I guess it was something that I was aware of. And then once I understood it, I would take advantage of it, because many of those clubhouse appearances that I mentioned, I would spend my time in the visitors' clubhouse because they didn't have anything like the competition for players for access. You're not fighting off 20 other guys to get to the star player. You can just walk up and talk to him. But I remember, and this is a LA related thing too, that I went to Yankee Stadium to talk to Mike Socia one time, and went to his pregame conference, and there were like three guys. And this is, again, for the whatever their name was at the time, Anaheim, California, Los Angeles, Newark, I don't know. But I mean, there were just no guys. And at the end of the thing, you know, they asked him two, three questions, and he actually said, "That's it? That's all you're going to ask me?" Don't you have any more questions? You would never hear that from a New York manager. And I ended up talking to him for about half an hour because he had nothing better to do.
Wow. Now, that's amazing. I haven't experienced that, to where someone said, wait, that's all you have, you know. But, you know, for the most part, like, yeah, they've been all graced with their time. You mentioned, too, about going on the road or getting the road visitors clubhouse. That's really, if you're on the beat, that's where you make your bones, basically. You build your relationships. That's why I go to spring training every year, try to help that out. You know, I'm there every day, so the players sort of see me. I don't really go on the road much. I'll go to occasionally to San Diego, although as we're recording this, the Dodgers are in San Diego, and I did not go down there this weekend. But I did cover one series in Oakland a couple years ago. I still haven't gone up to San Francisco, but I did a couple series in Arizona. But for the most part, I don't go on the road. But that's really where you can get a lot done as a beat writer, because it's like, you know, like you said, there's four people really in that clubhouse. So, and the players are much more, I don't know, inhibited is the right word, but they're just more, you know, freer and more real probably. And then they know it's just the main guys are around and not some local yahoos they have to deal with.
So I asked you about your story, your personal journey, both because I wanted to know, because that's a heck of a transition to make from somebody who didn't plan this as a career to someone who has made such a successful career out of it, but also because you're at SB Nation, and that in itself is kind of your story in a way is kind of the apex of the siren song of SB Nation. And I think people know this, full disclosure, I was there 3 years. The one aspect of it that I was never that comfortable with was kind of, and this is unfortunate and maybe one reason why I'm not still there, is kind of the founding idea of it. And you can correct me if I'm wrong, but as I understood at the time, going back many years now, this was founded by Tyler Blazinski, who was a pal of, and still is a pal of, Marcos Melitas of Daily Kos. He looked at the grassroots way that site grew up, with a lot of people contributing to it and forming kind of a community around liberal politics. And the idea at SB Nation was that those professional guys that we've just been talking about, the beat writers, the media, they interpose themselves between the true fan and talking about the team. So you were going to have these sites that covered the team with a real, again, I guess to use the word grassroots feel to it. The thing is that it's not a grassroots site. It's now part of a much larger media entity, which is Vox, which has done a lot of very successful things, particularly, I think, the Ezra Klein site. Vox, also called Vox, is just does a spectacular job covering many, many aspects of the news. They own other sites in different areas, non-sports, non-politics areas. But the attraction, the way that people still get brought in, is that they are told, look, write for us, and it's a platform, it's an opportunity, and look at these other people that have been here and have subsequently graduated to other things. And yet, I think that's a very small percentage of the people who do contribute there, and some people contribute very intensely, some people contribute casually, and just to define intensely. And I don't know if you ever thought about it this way, Eric, but, you know, your SB Nation page keeps a running counter of everything that you've done.
Yes.
For SB Nation. And you've been there 8 or 9 years. So I was just thinking that on average, you've got about 25,000 posts at SB Nation, which my math is not great, but that works out to 3,000 posts per year. And similarly, you have made roughly 180,000 comments.
Yes.
In those 8 years. And that's like 25,000 comments per annum.
Yeah.
That's a commitment.
Yeah. It's been it's been my life really for like the better part of 8 years or whatever. It got really intense when the regional sites were up, because I was doing a lot of posts for that. I think I went back and looked recently, every New Year's Eve or so, I'll go back and look at my post count for the previous year. And usually just for Trubo LA, my general average is like five posts a day. That's in recent years, which is actually a lot because that counts like the off season when there's like no news. But even that, that's like almost 2,000 posts in a year. A couple years, I think in like 2011 or 2012, combined with like SB Nation, the SB Nation LA and True Blue LA, I think I hit like over 4,000 one year. And I just remember looking back and like, I'm like, how was that even possible? Like, it was like absurd. So yeah, I don't know how I did it. There was just a lot of, you know, it's just a lot of time doing it. It's like, sometimes it feels like every waking hour, honestly. But yeah, it is, it's a time commitment. Like you talked about like the sort of premise of the site. We sort of went through an editorial change at SB Nation this year. Elena Bergeron is the new editor in chief there. I think they did a site like overhaul with some redesigns and stuff. And part of that site overhaul, there was like a new sort of commitment and like a mission statement. And I believe part of the mission statement, the main thing was come fan with us, on some level, it's like, okay, I get it. But like, I've always, and this sounds weird to say because I'm not ungrateful, but like I know it's a fan site, but I've never treated my work here like a fan site. Like I've always just used it as like, this is my sort of method for getting in the door. And I've just written like just pretty much straight down the middle. I think that's generally my style. I'll get into commentary now and again, although like just doing like covering the team, I find I don't have the time to do commentary stuff. I wish I had more time to do that. But for the most part, I don't consider myself writing as a fan. It's like a weird sort of dichotomy. I know the commenters certainly are fans, and I'm definitely a part of the commenters. So I'm not trying to like distance myself, but I just feel like I've tried to take on a more, I guess, professional is the way to put it, because, and I don't want to downgrade other sites, but yeah, not every site's equal in that regard. So I think it's kind of a weird dichotomy, really.
And I'm not trying to put you on the spot at all, nor am I trying to make you a spokesperson for SB Nation as a whole, which, as we said, is multifarious, and those sites are run by a lot of different people. There are a lot of different attitudes and approaches that come with those sites. Some people are very committed and, as you said, have a fairly professional bearing about the whole thing. Others less so, and I know there was a lot of turnover while I was there in terms of those sites. I'm sure there's subsequently been a great deal more turnover. I know there are great people I still consider friends, who are tasked just with kind of riding herd on that and making sure that those sites don't kind of fly off out of their orbits and either stop functioning or publish things that will bring somehow embarrassment to the brand. But the things we've discussed are the explanation for what you've been able to do, both in terms of your approach and also your commitment and just your general ability. I mean, as I said when we began, I think of you as a really super competent person and a very organized person. You are able to juggle a lot of balls where I juggle very, very slowly. So I was always very impressed with that. But I also think that you're an outlier. And I don't want to say that you're the only person who's ever come out of SB Nation and gone on to other things. And I mean, and you're still there, but you've made yourself so integral. Others have left and gone to other places and have done some great things as professionals also. But this industry that we're in, it seems like the number of full-time jobs is shrinking, that the opportunity to graduate that way. And when you do graduate, if you're going to some of these sites are not paying full-time wages. They're paying $25 or $50 a story or something very, very small. So does that basic appeal, the intake that is sold to everyone, come right for us for free? And at the other end of the rainbow, there'll be pie and cake and riches. It does that still apply? Is it still a thing that is valid to say to people?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, honestly, I think you could say it even not knowing how long like that train tunnel is, you know. I think people, if you're not doing it, but and you just want to get your foot in the door, and this is your way to sort of be, you know, semi-legitimate, I guess, in a way, and you've never, like, you know, you don't have another outlet to sort of, you know, write about your team or get in the door about covering a team or something like that, I think that's probably the way to go. And I don't know whether you buy the issue that one day it's going to lead to bigger and better things, but I think if you're, and you just want to get in that world, I think that's probably what they're really offering, even if it doesn't lead to something long-term. So I don't know, maybe it's that. And I really don't know, but I mean, it's a great question. It's one I've thought about too. Like, I always thought, like, you know, sometimes you think, like, what's the end game? But I don't really think about that a ton, because I consider myself, like, living the dream. People always say, if you're happy doing what you're doing, working, then you're not, it's not really work. I mean, obviously, I'm putting in a lot of hours. It is work. I think I'm lucky. Like, my office, most home games is the press box at Dodger Stadium, or I'm working from home. Literally right now, I'm at my cousin's house. I could do this from almost anywhere. So I have a certain sense of freedom in that regard. So I consider myself, like, insanely lucky, but I don't really know how you would sell someone on, like, starting this from scratch or like getting in on the ground floor. I don't know. I guess it would just depend on what their mindset is.
I think you're absolutely right. And again, I don't want to sell short the opportunity.
Yeah.
I just, for me, it was one thing for, like, you and I to be working together on the main site, and I know that you're compensated for being there. So for me to say to you, hey, Eric, can you come early? Hey, Eric, can you stay late? Hey, Eric, can you write 5 extra stories tonight? Like, at least I know you're going to walk out of that with a check in your pocket. But yeah, when I was doing stuff for the team sites, and I'm having to say to people, okay, well, you did this many free stories. Can I book you for, like, 5 free stories a week? Can I know that you're going to be here to monitor the comments on an ongoing basis so that I can spend some time with my kids? You know, things like that. Like, this is a defect for me as somebody who was spent years being a middle manager in this online baseball thing. I really like to pay people for their work.
Sure.
And I'm not comfortable asking people to do something for nothing. And yet that was the premise. And then maybe they might graduate to, like, well, here's $10 an article. Here's, you know, lunch money. And again, they're getting into it knowingly, like, nobody's being exploited, but I still felt bad about it.
Yeah, that's really the ongoing issue. That compensation is not for the team side. It's not really, like you said, it's not enough to, like, live on. So, and I've always felt like I'm going to run this site, like, how I want to run it, because I'm not, like, if you want to give orders or whatever on how to run a site, then you should also be paying me full time, you know, to run said site or whatever. But, right. And then, like, obviously not getting into specifics, but that's been the hardest thing sometimes, is you're selling someone on a labor of love. Like, they have to have it in them to just want to get out, like, all this information. Like, I've found a couple of minor league writers, because I don't have the time to cover all the minor leagues in addition to, like, the majors and stuff. So I've generally, like, pawned that off on other people. And Brandon Lennox for years did it. David Hood does it now. I kind of lucked into him. He, from some Rockies friends through SB Nation, he lives in Tulsa, and the Dodgers a couple years ago moved their AAA team to Oklahoma City and their AA team to Tulsa. So he started writing for me, and he's like, I just love writing about prospects, and I figure with the teams here, I could help you out. So he's been great, and he's been able to see games at, like, both parks and stuff. And then another local guy, Craig Manami, he goes to a lot of the Rancho Cucamonga games, which are close out here. And so I've been really lucky to have those, and I consider them friends too. But yeah, like I said, I can't really offer them much in terms of compensation. It's just, you know, almost like gas money. I never forced, like say, if you want to write something, go ahead. I'm never going to say, where are my X amount of posts this week or whatever. Just do what you want to do. Write what you need to write. If something comes up and you can't do it, just let me know. And it's been fine that way. But yeah, I'm the same way. I can't really, how can you get mad at a guy for for not doing something that you're not really compensating him for doing. You know, like it's weird.
Right. It is. So in the time that we have remaining, let's get back to the Dodgers for a second. The Dodgers are on a pace for 107 wins as we're speaking now. They're basically last year's Cubs. They don't have the in terms of record anyway. They don't have the best record in baseball because Houston's just been ridiculous. But that's by any measure, at least in terms of the regular season, a historically great team to win 107 games. Are they really that good? Do you see them sustaining this pace throughout the rest of the campaign?
Man, like going into the season, you know, it was sort of a kind of a fun joke in the offseason because when the Pecota rankings came out, they were, I believe, picked to win 98 games. And it was funny because there's always alterations to the Pecota formula, like after it comes out. And I think, but there were like alterations that day to the point where I wrote something in the morning when it came out. They were on pace for like, or they were projected to win 98 games. And I think by the time I wrote the piece, it was already up to 99. And I was like, how did they get a game better? But no, but the key takeaway from that is they were like 8 games better than the Cubs. Coming into this year, I'm like, there's no way they're 8 games better than the Cubs. You know, like that's insane. And so I actually thought they were going to be really good. I didn't write an actual prediction type preview this year, but I just talking to people, the number in my head and the number I used was like 96 wins. That's where I sort of thought this team petered out. I think it's probably the best team of this like 5-year run. 2013 was really good. They were also really like fragile too. Everything has sort of gone really right for them, or a lot of things have. They've used a lot of DL trips. Some of those strategic, not, you know, they haven't really been that besieged by injuries like they did last year. They lost Kershaw for 10 weeks. They did lose Julio Urias for this year and most of next year. So that's actually pretty huge too, because I sort of expected him to be a much bigger part of the rotation than he has been. But yeah, this is a long way of me saying they're not 107 win good, but at this point, given their start, I kind of expect them to get 100 now. That's sort of where I'm, because I thought they were going to win 96, but they were 53-28 at the halfway point, and so I think they're good enough to finish it off and win 100.
Tyler Kepner has an article in the New York Times today about the way that they're using their pitching staff.
Yeah.
And I think it's a fairly enlightened way of using it, which is to say they've accepted the point. And this is something that's been known as long as I've been following baseball. I remember Bill James writing about this, that the third time through the batting order, the pitcher is just not going to be effective, period. There's not a lot of upside there. So they've almost planned like 6 innings and out, bye. And the one question I have about that is, can a bullpen sustain that throughout the season without burning out? Do they have the kind of depth that they can do that and still have any life left in that pen when they get to October?
I think they can. I know like they have basically last year and this year. I think it was some of the narrative that surrounded like the way they lost to the Cubs was Joe Blanton pitched in like he pitched through 80 innings last year, and he gave up the grand slam to Miguel Montero, and then I think he gave up 3 total home runs in the NLCS. So the narrative was, well, he got burned out because he was used too much. I think that's a little too simplistic, just because he was actually lights out in the NLDS against the Nationals. So I'm not sure if you can pick and choose a point where someone gets burned. I think he just hung a slider to Montero, basically. And he's Joe Blanton. That's what he does sometimes. But he was really good for them. I think the bullpen is that good, but also for the term, at least in terms of the regular season, it is that deep. Like, for instance, Brandon Morrow was a guy I thought he was going to make the club out of spring training. He was a non-roster invitee, and he was just lights out in spring training. I thought he was great. Ended up not making the team. He's come up a couple times since then, and I think he's at 11 innings right now. 11 scoreless innings with like 13 strikeouts. He's barely allowed anything. They have like Josh Raven, who's probably a pretty good arm if they needed him. He's in AAA. They've been shuttling. Josh Fields is back up now. He was really good for a while. He gave up some home runs. They sent him down. They've basically been using their some of their prospects as like long relievers this year too. Ross Stripling was like sort of long reliever and high leverage guy for a while. Brock Stewart's been sort of the late inning long reliever now. I do think they are deep enough. The one thing they are strategic about is they've carried 13 pitchers for most of the year, And most of the time, that's an eight-man bullpen. They've shuffled in, like, at times, Kenta Maeda or Hyunjin Ryu have been out of the rotation, and they haven't been able to – they don't send those guys down. They just put them in the bullpen, and actually both guys have a four-inning save this year. This actually year has been great in terms of, like, I grew up in the 80s. I love the 80s style of baseball. And
me too.
It's almost been that kind of bullpen use at times in terms of they've had a lot of guys go multiple innings. They've had four different guys get three or more inning saves. It's been wonderful. Like, it's just been this, like, this awesome mishmash of, like, modern and old at the same time. I do think there's depth. Most of last year they had a 13-man staff. So they, even though they are, you know, cranking out pitchers at a record rate, there's enough to go around. I think they really don't go 3 days in a row for guys, except every so often. And they really back off if a guy's been overworked. So there's really not instances of guys getting really overworked a ton. Last year, they made 607 pitching changes, which was a record.
Right.
This year, they're not on pace for that. They're well under that. So even though they're still doing, like, the same style, I think the starters have been better to the point where they haven't had to use the bullpen as much. So I think they're even probably a little more rested at this point than they were last year. Although, like I said, last year, they being without Kershaw for 10 weeks really does tax the staff. Having Kershaw able to go really helps them out. And then Alex Wood becoming the second coming of Kershaw, even at maybe a six-inning level instead of a seven-inning level, is a nice little plus too. But, the short answer is that, yes, I do think they have the depth to do it. That said, trade deadline, I'm certain they're going to try to get at least one starter, probably at least one reliever, maybe two. So they're going to try to augment what they have to sort of add to that depth.
I want to ask you about two players, one who fascinates me and one who I think fascinates everybody. And by that, you can probably guess who it is. Justin Turner has now played about 450 games as a Dodger over 4 years. He's a career, about 310 hitter with them. Yeah. He's hitting roughly 390 as we speak. And obviously, no one expects him to sustain that. But who knows? Stranger things have happened, particularly this year. What is amazing about him is, in a sense, he's a classic late bloomer. He's 32 now. He doesn't really get to be a regular until he's almost 30. Three teams prior to the Dodgers missed on him. And the one that I think must particularly gall Orioles fans is the Orioles, because they didn't even give him a real look. They just had him and let him go for nothing. But what is it about this guy that other teams didn't see that, or that he was unable to access, that in coming to Los Angeles allowed him to be this all-star level player?
Yeah, it's a good question. You talked about the Orioles. It reminds me of I just remember it being weird looking back and seeing that Curt Schilling and Steve Finley were both on the Orioles at one point. And they're like, what? That actually happened. So it's the same thing with Turner, but yeah, it's one of the great stories, I think, in recent history. I don't know if it's just like, you're like a utility guy and you just finally get that everyday spot. He obviously worked for it. He worked with Marlon Byrd, I guess, which is funny because really shortly after that, Marlon Byrd was popped for PEDs.
Right.
And so you could make whatever inference you want there. But no, Turner, you know, is part of this fly ball revolution almost. He revamped his swing a little bit and just hitting more fly balls. I don't think that captures all of it because he's from out here. So there was that part of that, like, coming home and then also wanting to prove that he was still sort of worthwhile, because when he was on the Mets, it seemed like he had a very good reputation for being like a clubhouse guy. And just right. A good guy in the clubhouse. But then as he left, they non-tendered him after 2013. And there were like stories that said he was not a hard worker and all this. It's like, what? Like that seems like out of character. So I tweeted something earlier because I looked it up. Like you said, he's basically George Brett this year right now, which is very odd. He's just sort of hitting even better than he did his first 3 years. But he has like 144 WRC plus and 16.5 WAR, the Fangraphs version. So I decided during that same span, 2014 to now, I looked up all the Mets hitters, and Curtis Granderson pops out at 10.2 WAR. Yoenis Cespedes has 141 WRC plus. He's the only one sort of close to Turner. So I thought that was kind of funny. But like I said, I don't have an answer for it. They didn't expect that much of him here at first. He was just going to be like a an extra guy in the backup infielder at a lot of positions, and he wrestled the job away from Juan Uribe by like his second year, and he's basically held on to it ever since. It's been a remarkable rise, and it was literally rewarding for him like this offseason to get that. He got that $64 million deal. He and Kenley Jansen, I think, were the two biggest free agent moves that the Dodgers like had to make. They just didn't really have a backup plan if those guys left. It would have been very difficult had those guys left. You can't really replace them. Whatever internal budget they may have or limits they may have placed on themselves, it's very important for them to stretch that out a little bit. I know it's odd to say that with a team with like a $250 million payroll or whatever, but I'm sure at some level they have limits, but they exceeded those, I think, to get those guys back.
He's an interesting case of, and this is a cliche at this point, but it was a big thing, the Moneyball thing, where people were arguing about stats versus scouting. And I think that's resolved itself in terms of both, which was always the answer. But Turner was a guy who hit about .310 in the minors also. And yeah, not with a ton of pop, but some decent plate judgment. But it was almost like, nah, not real, not happening. We don't believe in that in terms of giving him 500 at bats and seeing if that .310 will translate to a decent .285, .290 in the major leagues. And it turns out it does.
Yeah. And then also, I think too, with the power, I always thought of him as a doubles guy, and he was like, he had a ton of doubles. And then last year, the power really started to kick in. He had this like a really slow start to the season last year. I think he had like 3 home runs on the season at some point, you know, mid June. And then he ended up with like 27 on the season. He went just on a crazy run and helped. The Dodgers were like 8 games back at the break last year. And Turner, Yasmani Grandal, and those guys on the offense essentially made up for the fact that Kershaw was out, and that sort of fueled their run to the division title. It's crazy. Like, even this year, I think he only has, 7 home runs. But like I said, he's hitting doubles, and he's one of those guys. Like, we talked about, like, Adrian Gonzalez earlier. I know, you know, certain guys are put up numbers. But sometimes when it comes down to the playoffs, because I never want to be that guy who just completely discounts something. But there are certain guys you trust in like big situations or against like almost any pitcher. Like when the Dodgers had Hanley Ramirez, like he was that guy. He was always going to be the guy to hit like excellent pitching. Like, it didn't really matter who was pitching for me. Like he was going to be okay against whoever was pitching. I sort of consider Turner in that regard. And in a weird way, I consider Gonzalez, if he's healthy, he was really good against Aroldis Chapman last year in terms of having, you know, good at bats against him. But yeah, Turner's one of those guys for me where like he's basically been entrenched. He's their number 3 hitter, and I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. Same thing with Seager. It's only his second year, but I implicitly trust that when Seager's up to bat, that like they're in good hands. So to have Seager and Turner 2-3, and now Cody Bellinger, who's on pace for, you know, 800 career home runs, hitting fourth, like that's a pretty good 2-3-4, I think, for now.
I love the walks with Seager, and that's not something that was there last year. I think he had about 50 walks last year or 55 walks. He's at 45 this year, so he's going to sail past his total last year sometime this month. And if he stays healthy, he's going to walk, you know, 90 times this year.
Yeah, it's been like a really nice surprise, and I think part of it is people recognizing more, like, oh yeah, okay, this guy's for real, and pitching around him more. That has been a real nice surprise, and he was off to a little bit of a slow start in the power department, but he's basically on pace for the season he had last year, you know, plus walks, which is great.
So I'm sure you anticipated my last question based on the way I set this up, but and I apologize if this is something that you're asked about constantly, picking up your dry cleaning, any social occasion that you might go through. But what is your go-to capsule paragraph when somebody asks you to explain Yasiel Puig?
Yeah, I mean, he's had one of the more bizarre careers ever, because, you know, we're sitting here talking about Corey Seager and Cody Bellinger, how great of a start they've had, but like no one was as white hot of a superstar out of the gate as Yasiel Puig was those first couple months. You know, he really was amazing, even like his first 2 years, I would say, were really good. But then it's just weird, like it's been a weird ride with him. This is his fifth year. I would say two really good years and then two really mediocre injury filled years. He had hamstring problems the last 2 years, but then also, you know, all the stuff that goes along with it, the reported attitude problems, which some of that is true, some of it's not. They did send him down last year, and one of the reasons they did was literally, I think Dave Roberts said, the coaching staff was spending an inordinate amount of time just dealing with Puig, and that was like a weird, that was struck me as a weird thing. But like, I think also they wanted him to work on his swing. They sent him down for a month. I do think that was like a big wake up call for Puig. He came back, was like pretty productive when he came back. They almost used him strictly as a platoon player in September and October last year. This year he's been more every day, and he's been like productive. Like he's gonna set a career high in homers this year. He's already at 15. He only had 11 the last 2 years. His career high is only 19, which is weird to me. In previous years, I think the Dodgers counted on Puig being that middle of the order guy, that he was like part of their plans. I think this year, one of the reasons they're so good is that they I don't know if they expected much from him. Like, he's just another guy. He's been like this, mostly hitting sixth, seventh, or eighth most nights. He's not a guy they necessarily count on. He's a guy who's been productive. He's a very good fielder. And then he's really picked it up on offense the last month or so. So his numbers are overall pretty good and right. But I just think like they're not reliant on him, which sort of makes his production like, you know, extra special in a way, because they're getting it more from the bottom of the order. He's still that national name that, you know, people still ask about, even though his relative importance to the team is less than it's ever been. But like at the same time, the fact that he's producing is like a just like this huge plus for them. So the Dodgers are always rumored to be going after some outfielder or whatever, and Puig's name usually comes up. But to me, like, unless there's some obvious upgrade, it's tough to see him. Well, I don't know. I can't say it's tough to see him getting dealt, but it's just bizarre. I'm not sure I know how to properly describe Puig, but it's just he's just been a nice sort of addition to the team this year, and not like the focal point.
Being in the clubhouse, I don't think, at least for me, was a great way to, you know, gaze into somebody's soul and understand their character. First of all, the players are generally not acting out in front of the media, at least in my experience. They've got private areas that maybe they can do that in. But whether a guy is, to use vastly overbroad terms, whether he's good or evil, is a great team guy or a negative presence, when he's sitting in his locker pulling on his pants, he looks just like anybody else. And you can't tell whether he's thinking, I should give more to charities, or I want to kill all of these people with a machete. Like, you don't know. So what I wonder is there anything about Puig that is visible to you just as a casual observer there in the clubhouse that sets him apart from other players and makes him such a lightning rod?
Yeah, I think some of it early on was visible. No, not really this year. Just there have been times when he's been kind of prickly, you know, with me, but that happens sometimes with like a lot of players. So that's not like singling him out, but I think it's like in combination sometimes with some of the things like you mentioned, showing up late and then being sort of indignant about it, or sometimes not really wanting to, you know, talk to the media after a specific incident or something like that. But yeah, it is, like you said, it's not, I'm not sure if it's truly ever visible to us. And it's more, I think, the actions and then, you know, what we sort of find out happens behind the scenes, I guess. But yeah, it like you said, it's difficult. That said, I think this year he's been fine. I know he's had a couple like incidents, but I think those were over. He did the double bird to a couple fans who were getting on right. In Cleveland, and it was fine. Like, I mean, it was kind of funny, but like I understood why. He had an incident with the Mets where he absolutely destroyed a pitch. I forgot who was pitching, but he completely admired the home run and it's coming out of the box, and Wilmer Flores took exception. He was playing first base and said as much to Puig as he was rounding first base, and Puig took exception to that and yelled, but he kind of turned around and basically told him to F off. And the weirdest part about this whole incident to me was that, to his credit, Angel Hernandez, which who by all accounts, I don't think I've ever met anyone who actually likes Angel Hernandez as an umpire. But to his credit, he was first base umpire. He like saw what was happening between Flores and Puig. And so as Puig was rounding first, Hernandez like sort of walked in between them to like make sure it didn't escalate, you know? And I was like, okay, that was a pretty like subtle little move there. That was good on Angel Hernandez. But the funniest part about that whole thing was Yoenis Céspedes and Jose Reyes, like between innings, having a talk with Yasiel Puig, explaining on how like they didn't appreciate that or whatever. And then literally like less than a week later, Yoenis Céspedes had a home run where his home run trot was slower than Yasiel Puig. So I just thought that was kind of funny. But yeah, so like he's going to just because of his past, I think he gets blown up a little bit more where something rather innocuous happens. But more people are going to attach that to like to something in 2013 or whatever. So it's still funny. It's funny to me more than anything.
How did Dave Roberts and the Dodgers handle that flipping off incident? Because, you know, for me, one really famous baseball story from when I was quite young, Gary Templeton, the Cardinals shortstop, doing a similar thing. I believe that was the home crowd, which may be the crucial difference in this instance. Similarly, Ted Williams flipped off the home crowd also. That certainly hurt his relationship with the fans for pretty much forever until he became very old and people became sentimental about him. But when you read about that Templeton incident, that was a breaking point for the player and the team. Whitey Herzog was done with him pretty much. He was just immediately yanked out of the game. It was a huge stigmatizing incident, whereas it seems that with Puig, that the Dodgers downplayed it. There really didn't seem to be a lot of consequences for it, and you know, nobody really cared.
Yeah, they did have like I believe Roberts like took him aside and like sort of, I think they had like a talking to, but like nothing huge. Like there wasn't like you've let us down as a teammate or whatever. But it was more like, yeah, you should just more like be aware of your surroundings. Like, you know, if you're going to do something like that, like don't do it when everybody's watching. I think it was more that than anything. But yeah, they, like you said, it is weird. But like you said, it was a road crowd, so it was a little bit different. I think if he was doing something to the home crowd, there'd probably be more of a backlash.
It occurs to me that now, belatedly, and I'm probably not the kind of guy to write this story because people would mock the hell out of you, but there'd be a place for kind of one of these bad hot take stories where you could talk about, you know, the Dodgers tolerated Puig doing it. That means that our society overall has coarsened and we're just more barbaric than we used to be because we just don't care when ball players who are role models are flipping off little children in the stands, and oh, the little children.
That'd be perfect. I'd read.
And that would be the end of me. So I think we'll leave that one on the, I don't even, I mean, I'm surprised that nobody wrote it. Eric, I want to thank you very much for taking the time. It was such a pleasure working with you all those years ago and watching you in action. I don't use the term super competent easily. You don't run into a lot of people like that. It really was a joy to do that and great talking to you here. I really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks a lot, Steven. This has obviously been a lot of fun. It's been fun catching up with you and also, you know, pretty a lot of fun just being on your podcast. Thanks for having me.
By Neptune's beard, we have reached the end of another episode. You can follow Eric Steven on Twitter at TrueBlueLA. At last, someone who doesn't just have their name in their Twitter handle. You can find his work at the website of the same name in incredibly high volume. You can follow me at GoStevenGoldman, because when you go Steven Goldman, you go first class. And of course, you can read me here 3 times a week on FanRag. As some of you already have, you can write us at infiniteinning@gmail.com. Always happy to hear from you. I'm sometimes a little tardy in responding, but I will, I promise. And please rate us, review us, subscribe at the podcatcher of your choice, and iTunes especially. It helps to get the word out. No sponsor this week, so we'll just say that we're brought to you by the number 21.
Our producer suffered a broken kneecap in a wiffle ball game when he told me he'd strike me out on a curveball. Thing is, I'm partially blind. Anybody can strike me out. So I'd like to think that the spontaneous fracturing of his knee was an act of God, a punishment for his hubris and general insensitivity to the mildly handicapped. Our theme song, The Infinite Man, which you have heard throughout this episode and, in fact, are hearing now, was co-written by myself and Dr. Richard Mooring. I'd tell you what he's up to, but he's been on vacation and he doesn't love me enough anymore to even send a postcard. Well, if I can just get this bathysphere to lift me off the muddy bottom of the Challenger Deep, it's a long way up. I'll be back next week with more tales and discussion from inside the infinite inning.